These are the Proverbs of Solomon, David's son, king of Israel. Their purpose is to teach people wisdom and discipline, to help them understand the insights of the wise. Their purpose is to teach people to live disciplined and successful lives, to help them do what is right, just, and fair. These proverbs will give insight to the simple knowledge and discernment to the young. Let the wise listen to these proverbs and become even wiser. Let those with understanding receive guidance. By exploring the meaning in these proverbs and parables, the words of the wise and their riddles. For the Lord is the foundation of true knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. This is God's word.
All right. And now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So as I just mentioned to the kids, wisdom is our theme for the year. And it's not just something that's in the Bible, like a feature. It's not just that things in the Bible are wise. Wisdom in the Bible is actually a literature type. In the era the Bible was written, there were pieces that were understood to be wisdom literature. And in our Bible, there are entire books that fall within this category. And if you think about them, if you're familiar with the Bible, you could maybe sense that they're a little different. So Proverbs is one of them, the most well-known. Another is Job. Another is the book of James, that often in the New Testament feels a little different. And actually, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, in many ways, can be understood as wisdom literature. So we're going to look at all of those throughout the year. And wisdom is something that we thought about because it's an elusive idea to some degree, but a really necessary one. What is wisdom? Whose wisdom is right? You could find people that would report to have wisdom, but it would be different from someone else's wisdom. Beyond that, I think in our day, in our culture, we're asking questions such as, are we getting better at discovering wisdom or worse at discovering wisdom based on the way that our culture works and based on the way that technology works? Are we being formed to actually discover wisdom? And we're going to spend our year exploring lots of topics. Another feature of the year is we're going to follow the church calendar, which we haven't always done. But this year, we want to try it. It might be something we continue. But it's an especially cool year to do it because wisdom can be arranged very well according to the church calendar. There are a lot of ways that we can take things like ordinary time in the church calendar and put a lot of interesting topics in there. So that's one of the reasons I've been asking you all for the questions you have, the ways you're seeking wisdom, is we can go in a lot of different directions. We don't have to go in sequential order. In fact, wisdom literature generally doesn't require that you do. Finally, as a feature for the year, we're going to try to use wisdom literature the way it was meant to be used, which means you have to exercise. You have to exercise your mind. Wisdom literature is not something that you just hear. Wisdom literature was meant to be something that you tried on and you tested and you debated and you wrestle with, you grapple with. And so we're going to try to do some things like that, which is part of why I am actually going to, in this sermon, stop a couple different times. One of those is going to come up soon. And I've been asking for topics, and I want to just gather them right now, today, in like 2 minutes. So some of you got a bulletin on the way in and there's a little blank spot on the bottom. There are also pieces of paper in the chairs in front of you. And I want you to capture some things you're thinking about, such as, these days I feel confused by this. That would be something you're seeking wisdom on. Or this, thinking about this overwhelms me. Okay, that would mean it's something you're wrestling with, but you're not sure. That's something you're seeking wisdom on. I wish I knew what to do about this. That would be something you're seeking wisdom on. I feel like I need help figuring out this. That would be something you're seeking wisdom on. Or it could even be, I wish people were curious about what I know about this. Something that you have gleaned some wisdom on, that you wish other people would think about. Okay? I know you all have these things within you. I know it because this is a pretty small church. I've met you all, actually, most of you. I've talked to you. And in even just short little conversations, I hear these kind of ponderings that you're confused by things, overwhelmed by things, wishing you understood, thinking about the future and not knowing what to do in the future, right? Looking at a decision you have to make, going, is that the best one? That's wisdom questions. And the thing about the Bible is it doesn't tell you the answer. Wisdom helps you discern. It also doesn't tell you the answer, but it forms you to make a good decision. Here's a few things while you're thinking. I looked up, you know, what is Gen Z trying to figure out these days? And then, you know, I just did it because I'm still trying to figure Cruz out. I spend a lot of time with him and it's not making a lot of sense. So I Google things and try to figure it out. But Gen Z, what are they saying? They need wisdom. Here's a few of the answers I got. How to figure out a stable future financially. Housing's expensive. Pathways to retirement seem kind of dubious. The job market has changed. The economy feels volatile. What are we going to do in the future to have a meaningful life and to be secure? Gen Z reports needing a lot of wisdom on their well-being, especially mental health. One of the nuances of what I saw, this was a recent report, was that amidst high anxiety and stress, there's a deep sense of needing mental health care, but also a deep exhaustion with trying mental health care. Like, it takes a lot of time and money and doesn't always have the payoff you hoped. So Gen Z is trying to figure that out. What pathways are there to healing from the problems I have? Gen Z is thinking about having kids and worried about having kids because raising them in the world that they're observing with the uncertainties is a scary thing to do. Gen Z is trying to discern identity, what it means for relationships. In a world where your identity is highly valued, how do you share that with others? What about another person's identity? What about when your identity collides with another person's identity and you disagree? How do you hold this, as Quest mentioned, individualism with a need to live in a coherent society? How do you do it? How do you connect with others in a world where digital space feels safe, but it also feels disconnected? How do you live in such a world? Gen Z is trying to figure out how to impact the world. How to be involved in something like politics without either burning out because it feels like it's going nowhere, or overstepping your boundaries and doing something that somebody else thinks is wrong. Are all fights my fight? Can we even change the world? And why are we trying? What do we do with all the points of view that exist in the world? And Gen Z is struggling to balance work and recreation and technology. Now you can be your own boss and you can hustle and you can use AI, but there are questions, right? Is it making us dumberer? Is that a word? No. Sometimes it helps. Yeah. Sometimes it helps. Is there any way to disconnect from technology and still be productive in our world? Is there any way to stay on technology, use it in the way it helps, while resisting the addiction of it that makes you use it right in the middle of church? Is it just that Gen Z, broadly speaking, is thinking about these things? Or is it everybody? Is it everybody? It's tough for Gen Z, right? Because theirs is the future. So, Cruz, right? Like, you've got most likely years and years ahead of you, but you don't have the life experience that some of us have. But some of us don't know what it's like to be you, right? And the relationships across generations are fragmented in our society. So how could the wisdom of the elders be translated and given to those who have energy and have a whole world in front of them? How do you do it? That's why wisdom literature exists, to think through things like that. And I've barely scratched the surface. So have you written anything on your paper? I need you to write something on your paper, because I need to hear from you what you are thinking. And the first one that can tell me what they're thinking gets a piece of candy. This is how we're going to do this. I'm going to bribe you. First one to tell me. Maybe. Use discretion. Use wisdom. Too deep, too fast. All right, well, you tell me later. First one to tell me, though. It's a pretty good one. I got it over at the Purple Penguin. It's a jawbreaker. It's pretty good. Yeah, anybody? Anybody want a jawbreaker? I need to hear one. Harper, do you have a thing you want wisdom on? What pizza to eat? Harper, come get your candy. Come get it. Thank you for even speaking up. Give it two. Types of respect. Yeah. Hey, you know what? There you go. That's a great question. Is that yours? Well, then I'll give you one. Yeah. Is balance the answer to literally everything? I don't know. What happens when you don't listen to wisdom? Good question. Inga? What's that? Why is the lamp green? Out of bounds, but I'll still give it to you. Okay. One more, Daniel. Fear of man in the workplace. Oh, when you fear the fear of man, fearing what other people think of you in the workplace. Yeah. Yeah, Jules.
All right, this one's mine.
I've got a lot of candy here.
Is delayed obedience still obedience?
Brian. Did you have one?
I guess how to differentiate a conviction versus just a strongly held
or preference.
Preference.
Yeah, good. You wrote that down, right? Just hand it off to somebody. All right.
I want wisdom in writing.
What's that?
In writing. Wisdom in writing.
In writing. Yeah. Good. Paul?
I'm worried about finals.
Finals. What do I do? What do you do with your worry about upcoming finals? Good. I have more, but we can save it for later. Oh, all right. Okay. That's probably good for now. Thank you. Thank you for letting me bribe you. Yeah. So Proverbs, which is where we're starting, is wisdom literature. Like I said, Job, James, Sermon on the Mount. But Proverbs specifically was given to people. Now, okay, really quick. We read the beginning, right? It said the Proverbs of Solomon. Now, I hate to break it to you. Almost every historian would tell you this. Proverbs wasn't all written at once. It wasn't all written during the lifetime of Solomon. It's pretty common of ancient books like this to be attributed to like a very wise person and then to have a collection of people like them and their writings. And that's probably what this is. Solomon is like the famous wise person. And this would be things that are in the tradition of Solomon in many ways. And we know that this book probably came together and was delivered nearly 400 years after Solomon was king. And it was given to the people of Israel at a very important time. It's when they were returning from the Babylonian captivity. So their culture had been captured, and their culture had been taken over by Babylon. And after this, after years and years of this, it's interesting, Jules even mentioned like Jeremiah 29:11, which is this idea of like a hope and a future that people have. But when they got that verse, they were in captivity in Babylon, and they were actually told not to listen to the people that told them it was going to get better soon at the same time. So there's this like good future coming, but also not anytime soon. But once they got out of that, they were given the book of Proverbs. Why would you need wisdom? Why would you need riddles? Why would you need little quippy, clever sayings after being in captivity for a really, really long time? Well, their culture had been nearly obliterated. Their faith and their history had been nearly wrung out of them. They had been captive in a massive, powerful world culture. Does anybody remember the story of Daniel and his friends? So little Jewish boys who showed a lot of promise. And the Babylonians took them. And the reason they did this is they looked for skilled young boys. And they took them and they inundated them with the values of Babylon. Because they wanted to take the most influential people of the Jewish culture and teach them this new culture and wipe out their previous culture. So when you've been living in a culture that has rewired you, told you a new story and reformed you, you have to rebuild and you have to learn how to think again. Today, as we're reading from this introductory section, I want you to ask that question. Is there any chance that I have been to some degree rewired, re-narrated by my culture? Is that possible? Verses 2-6 that we read, that Ty read to us, say this: the purpose of parables is to teach people wisdom and discipline, to help them understand the insights of the wise, to teach people to live disciplined and successful lives, to help them do what is right, just, and fair. These proverbs will give insight to the simple, knowledge and discernment to the young. Let the wise listen to these proverbs and become even wiser. Let those with understanding receive guidance by exploring the meaning of these proverbs and parables, the words of the wise and their riddles. And then verse 7 is like the motto that's meant to be the key to the entire thing. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of all understanding. And though these may not have the same author, they all have the same premise. They all have the same God. What's unique about wisdom, this type of literature, it's not something we're very used to. We like media, and I do too, that gives us fast answers. This is why just in our team meeting, we were laughing at Angie for Googling something, right? Why? Because ChatGPT is faster, right? It gives, it, with Google, I mean, even though it's got Gemini going on, right? But think, I mean, Google used to feel fast, right? But you got fed sites and you had to look at the site and you had to find what you're looking for in the site. ChatGPT compiles the information, scraping the web, and provides you with the answer. We like that. And we've been moving in that direction for a long time. Even when we read books or Bible studies or Bible promise books or Bible answer books, have you seen those things in the Christian stores? In a way, a lot of those are saying, the Bible's really hard. Here's what it says in a short statement about how not to feel anxious. Here's a 20-word verse. You know? Good luck out there. But we like those things. We like to look at science. We were just talking to Daniel and Celeste about medical journals, right? And people put in all this work, and then somebody might just find their answer and use it in a different way without looking at the work and the original intent of what they were thinking, because that takes a lot of time. Wisdom literature, though, is meant to open up your imagination. Sometimes it'll present you with a contradiction. Sometimes it'll present you with something that's only true in certain situations and actually makes you respond to it. Like, that's not right. The goal of presenting it in that way is actually to get you thinking, to open up dialogue, discovery, and discussion. At the beginning of Tim Keller's Year of Proverbs, he has a nice little saying that explains what I just did. Wisdom is like hard candy. If you try to eat it fast, the experience is nowhere near the intended experience. If you just crunch, and I think I heard a couple of you do that, right? Goes in the mouth. You just have splinters in your mouth and it's gone really, really quickly. What it was designed for, and I actually asked the lady at Purple Penguin, I said, I want candies that have multiple sensory experiences or layers going on. There's your jawbreaker. Like a jawbreaker. That's why I asked the lady at Purple Penguin for these, because only when you take it in slowly do you experience the different layers that are going on inside. Okay? It's meant to be savored, and the layers are meant to be discerned. That's what a parable is. A modern situational parable would be, if the shoe fits, wear it. Does anybody know the cultural place where that came from? The cultural
Cinderella.
Yeah, exactly. Cinderella. Yeah. It's come to have a meaning, right? That it's about indirect insults, right? If I say something on social media, all Christians are morons, and somebody's like, well, I'm a Christian, I'm not a moron, I'll be like, well, I wasn't talking about you, but if the shoe fits, wear it. See what that's what it's come to mean. Ashley, you're going to have too much fun with this whole series, I'm afraid. You liked how I strut when I did that, yeah. If the shoe fits, wear it. My posts are never directed to anybody, but if the shoe fits, wear it, Cinderella. Like, that's a modern parable, but it's the same words could be reversed. You could say something like, just because the shoe fits doesn't mean it's about you. You could actually reverse that and it'd be true, right? You could say, like somebody could say, oh, I feel like Christians don't think ever. And then they might look at their friend and go, look, I know you're a Christian, but you're different. In a way, that would be saying, just because the shoe fit you doesn't mean it was about you. See, that's a parable. You have to understand the situation in which it applies.
So it's like, if somebody's laughing doesn't mean they're laughing at you.
You know, I always assume they are, but you never know. Yeah.
Well, I know you're laughing at me.
Another example would be the purposeful contradiction in parables. If you read them slow, you'll bump into this. Okay, so I have one for you. So yesterday, maybe on social media, you saw something about the conflict happening right now between the United States and Venezuela. Perhaps you saw something by someone else that you thought was biased or misinformed. Perhaps. Is that a stretch? No. So what do you do? What do you do? How do you respond to that? Wouldn't it be great if there was a verse in the Bible that would tell you what to do? Now, I have one for you. I have a pair. And they're actually one, they're in sequence. It's Proverbs 26, 4, and 5. You ready? Here's the answer. Here's what you do. Do not answer the foolish argument of fools, or you will become as foolish as they are. All right? Next verse. Be sure to answer the foolish arguments of fools, or they will become wise in their own estimation. Those are actually sequential Bible verses. Proverbs 26, in order. Do not answer the foolish arguments of fools, or you will become as foolish as they are. Be sure to answer the foolish arguments of fools, or they will become wise in their own estimation. What? Huh? Now, okay, what do we do with that? If that was an accident, I would be breaking your doctrine of Scripture right now. Because if every word is inspired by God and these are saying the opposite, right? But if it's a purposeful contradiction, then maybe it has a point. Because what's the point? Either one of these can be true, depending on a multitude of factors. So what factors do you need to consider to decide which one of these you should use? What factors? You can talk to me.
Do you have the fortitude to withstand the foolishness?
Do you have the fortitude to withstand the foolishness? Sure.
How will it be received?
Sure. Any other factors? The consequences of this. Yeah, if I open this can of worms, probably another parable in there. Yeah. What are the consequences? Anything else?
My motive in answering.
What is my motive in answering? Yeah, Cassie?
Is it public conversation or a private conversation?
Is it a public conversation or a private conversation? Excellent. I was, a few that I had. Who is making this argument? What is my relationship to them? I think that matters, right? Like, does my relationship have any weight in this conversation? Will they even listen to me? How about, do I have mastery on the subject to where I should be the one speaking? Have they exhibited receptivity to the input of others, or are they just looking to sound off? Those factors matter. Andrew. What's at stake in the winning or the losing? Yeah, absolutely. You've used the parable. See, that's the point. That's why it presents both. Because it's saying you need to think about more. And when you see the two in purposeful contradiction, you begin to exercise your mind.
Think before you say.
That's, what'd you say? Sorry, it sounds like you have candy in your mouth. Think before you say, yeah.
No, I thought I'm loud enough for you to hear me.
You did good. Another common form of parable or wisdom saying is a parallelism, two lines that reinforce one another. So actually verse 7, our final motto, the fear of the Lord is the foundation of true knowledge. This is a parallelism. The second line is going to clarify what that means. But fools despise wisdom and discipline. So there's something there. What does it mean to fear the Lord and have that be the foundation of true knowledge? They're clarifying the fool despises wisdom and discipline. So there must be something about wisdom and discipline that's part of that foundational idea of fearing the Lord. Okay? The problem is, right, you're trying to say, how do I become wise? How do I fear the Lord? The proverb is not going to tell you everything, but it's going to say, I'll tell you what the fool does. They despise wisdom and discipline. So you're going to have to think and create your own path, knowing that it's going to require an investment in wisdom and discipline. Biblical wisdom literature can be so frustrating because it doesn't spoon feed us the answers, but it is anchored onto a foundation. It declares that we can and must have a foundation and teaches us to build upon it. When I first went to seminary, I went to a philosophy heavy program, and I really appreciated a lot of what I learned there. One of the principles that one of my teachers was very big on was the idea of you must state your axiom. You have to state your base level foundational assumptions. Without that, you can't have a very coherent conversation. So this is good philosophy. Does anybody know where the word philosophy comes from? The love of wisdom. Philea Sophia, yeah. The love of wisdom. So if you do not know what wisdom you love, if you do not know where it comes from, your system, your belief system will be an incoherent system, or your argument or discussion with someone, if the two of you haven't named your premises, will be an incoherent argument. The best way to start is by naming your foundation, what your first principles are, right? And the basis and the good news of the opening of Proverbs is that there is a foundation that exists. Therefore, wisdom can actually be discerned. That is good news. Because I think a lot of our friends and neighbors don't know if that's true or not. And that makes it really hard to build coherent systems and argue and fight for the good, the right, and the true if you're not really sure good, right, and true are valid ideas. It's very good news for us in a culture that is powerful and formative, where there are fools all over the place. There's a song I like by a guy named Bob Schneider. If you just want to think about it, he just sings about how the fools are everywhere. It feels so true. But when confusion and there's so much information, it is good news to know there is a foundation of wisdom that exists. The good news of Christianity gets even more specific. Not only does wisdom exist, not only does the foundation exist, but unlike a building foundation, right? Like I'm showing you a building foundation and we're sitting on one, right? How do you know this is a good foundation? This is one of the things I looked at when we bought this building. How do you know?
No cracks.
Yeah, the building is good. The building's not falling. And if you look, the cracks are all designed, they're where they were designed to be, right? That's good. That's a fact. But Proverbs 1:7 presents more than a material fact. It's not just saying a foundation exists. It actually presents a foundation that can be feared. Now, that is an interesting concept. Like, I don't fear this foundation. It's just a fact, right? I don't fear 2 + 2 = 4. I don't fear that. What does it mean to fear something? Now, an element of wisdom or learning wisdom is always that it invites conversation. That's part of why I'm talking to you, but it also invites the insight of others. And so when we were in our team meeting, Mike accidentally signed himself up for this because he got excited. He was like, one of my first sermons was on the fear of the Lord. And so I was like, Mike, wisdom literature says we need to hear about that. So I'm actually going to have Mike come up here and tell you a little bit of what he learned years ago in one of his, was it your first sermon, Mike?
No, but it was one of
them. An early sermon he wrote when he was thinking about the fear of the Lord. So Mike's going to chat with us for a second here.
And I'm going to do the whole sermon because Andy probably won't go very long. Like Andy said, this was like a concept that was really impactful to me. It's like a core memory now where this was actually based off of a sermon series back during Epicenter, which was a church that merged into Mission. Some of you might have actually been there during this sermon, only a few of you. But it was about, it was a Q&A series, and people could kind of ask any question, kind of like what we're doing now, a little bit different. But one of the questions somebody asked was about the fear of God. Like, what is that, and what does it mean? because it's just a confusing idea, especially the way we talk about fear these days. And so I remember growing up and I heard a lot of, I had heard a lot of sermons where people talked about the fear of God almost as like, well, it's more like awe or reverence. But I also sensed that people were kind of uncomfortable with the idea of that word being used. And I also thought, like, well, then why didn't they just translate it that way? So I was kind of excited to be assigned that sermon and also kind of freaked out because I didn't know what it meant. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to do my due diligence and do my research and look into the, you know, the original languages and see what's actually going on here. So this was, I had kind of thought, and I heard somebody mention balance earlier. I had kind of thought, okay, it's probably somewhere in between. Like there, maybe there's reverence, but maybe there's a little bit of fear. But actually what I found was kind of surprising. And it actually is almost exactly just fear, just like being afraid. But there was a layer to it that I wasn't aware of before. And so this is the exciting part. When I looked up the words, these were the words that came up throughout the Bible when it talks about the fear of God. In the Greek, it shows up two times as phobos, which is where we get phobia, or fears. And then there's another word that's in Hebrew called pachad. That just means terror or dread. That's kind of all it means. And then the other 22 times it's used, I want to say, 21 times, there's this word called yirah, which is also a Hebrew word. And the top kind of A, B, C all just mean fear. It means like fear or terror, awesome or terrifying thing. The third one, C, is fear, parentheses, of God, can also be respect, reverence, or piety. So the overwhelming answer that I found was really just this is like kind of fear. And then I started thinking about and searching out all the times in the Bible where somebody encounters God or the angel of the Lord. And it's like, oh yeah, they fall down on their face. Or like Paul is knocked off of his horse and he's blinded. And most of the time people's responses are like, please spare me. Like, please don't hurt me, please. But do you guys remember what the response is? Basically every time when somebody does that, he says, fear not. So the interesting idea to me, the place I kind of ended up landing on it was that just like if you come upon like a lion in the jungle, are lions in the jungle? A tiger in the jungle or a lion in the Sahara, like there's a natural fear, just like, you know, the creator of the universe, this extremely powerful being that is perfect and perfectly righteous. And I'm here, I know the bad things I've done. And the Bible even says we like rebelled against him. Like, of course there's an innate fear, like, oh no, what did I do? But God's response to that every time is fear not. So essentially, like, to see God for who he is kind of fear-inducing, but that's just the beginning of wisdom, which is what these verses are talking about, because then we get to know who he is, and a big picture of sin can make an even bigger picture of grace. But that was really meaningful to me, and I still think about it a lot and blurt it out at staff meetings sometimes, and then you end up right here, so careful. Thanks, Andy.
Be careful. Yeah, the as he kind of alluded, the lion idea, right, is one that C.S. Lewis grappled with a lot. If you read the Narnia series, you've got the good lion, but the children at one point, right? This is the famous moment in the Chronicles of Narnia these days. Is he safe? You know, and the answer is no. He's not safe, but he's good, right? There's this idea of, and I think Lewis called it the numinous, and that was, I think, a term going around in his day, That was this idea of this combination of fear and benevolence that you could experience both at the same time. You know, if you're talking wisdom literature, somebody might throw out Lewis. And then as in our meeting, Cruz mentioned, yeah, but we aren't. Like sometimes when you're in the presence of good, Andy, you once told that story about your dad and the bad movie you watched in front of him. And you didn't feel afraid, but I did feel uncomfortable with this like gross thing that I'd brought into his presence. And there was that. And then I threw in this time when I thought I was about to die because of a pack of wolves. And they might have been wolves. That's the spoiler. But at the time, they were wolves to me. And that's really all that matters for the point of the story. But I walk around the corner in Greer on a hike. I'd gone out kind of late, and there they are, staring at me. Huge, maybe wolves. And in a moment like that, something happens to you. And it's an interesting thing to explain. I think it's what Lewis was getting at, and I wonder if it's a little bit what this concept is getting at. But I had a thought that was like, I might be about to die. And this could be my last stroll because they're looking at me and then they like move down the path. So it's like, well, I either go back into the canyon at night or I keep moving the direction of the wolves. So I picked up like 4 rocks that were the size of baseballs because that's my sport. And I was like, I think I can throw these semi-accurately. And that's really all I've got. So I put like 1 in my back pocket, had 2, just like, and I walked for like an hour with this awareness that maybe the wolves were right there. And I was going to have to try to throw my best baseball throw at 1 of 10 of them. And when I got onto the main road at the end of that hike, I thought, it was an interesting thought. I have never felt so invigorated in my life. So what does that mean? Wisdom literature gets you telling stories. Does that clear up the fear of God? No. But it starts to give you thoughts about what does it mean to experience fear? What if being in the presence of God actually was the most invigorating thing you've ever experienced in your life? What if it is? Okay. The final element of this ties in with our location in the church calendar, which is the celebration of Epiphany. Another word for Epiphany would be the manifestation. So we remember that, you know, Christmas has just ended, right? And the Magi from the East were these astrologers who were seeking something. They were seeking a sign, and what they find is more than they bargained for. They find the king. They find the savior of the world, and they come and they worship him. They find Jesus. Epiphany reflects the way that Jesus also is the light to the world. He brings light. He is an epiphany to all people. In the book of Luke, we have a moment recorded in which Jesus is being pressed to reveal his power. Show us who you are, is what they're saying to Jesus. And Jesus, or it goes on to say this, as the crowd pressed in on Jesus, he said, "This evil generation keeps asking me to show them a miraculous sign, but the only sign I will give them is the sign of Jonah. What happened to him was a sign to the people of Nineveh that God had sent him. What happens to the Son of Man will be a sign to these people that he was sent by God." So Jonah, 3 days in the sea, Jesus, 3 days in the grave. Then he goes on. "The Queen of Sheba will stand up against this generation on Judgment Day and condemn it, for she came from a distant land to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Now someone greater than Solomon is here, but you refuse to listen. The people of Nineveh will stand up against this generation on Judgment Day and condemn it, for they repented of their sins at the preaching of Jonah. Now someone greater than Jonah is here, but you refuse to repent." And then, did you know this is what follows that? "No one lights a lamp and hides it or puts it under a basket. Instead, a lamp is placed on a stand where the light can be seen by all who enter the house." Jesus refused to show them a miraculous sign, but he did show them wisdom. And Jesus has proven to be greater than Solomon. Not only did he couple wisdom with a consistent life, unlike Solomon was able to do, he was proven to be a prophet of God who is greater than Jonah. Not only did he give his life to preach to people and to warn them of judgment, but he actually defeated death by undergoing the judgment of God himself, though he didn't deserve it. Light's an interesting subject when you think about fear, too. In Ephesians 5:13, Paul notes that light exposes evil for what it really is. And when Jesus explained his coming of being born again to Nicodemus in John 3, he said this about himself. God sent his son into the world not to judge the world, but to save the world through him. There's no judgment against anyone who believes in him, but anyone who does not believe in him has already been judged for not believing in God's one and only son. And the judgment is based on this fact. God's light came into the world, but people loved the darkness more than the light, for their actions were evil. All who do evil hate the light and refuse to go near it for fear that their sins will be exposed. But those who do what is right come into the light so others can see that they are doing what God wants to be done. Jesus, the light of God, the epiphany, the manifestation of God, draws near to those who walk in wisdom, who desire wisdom. And fear, the fear of the Lord, actually compels them and warms them in his presence. It invigorates. Those who do not want to be near the light avoid it because it feels like judgment. What a gift that the wisdom of God is not just conceptual. It's not just something to ponder in the mind. It's actually something you can feel and know and understand personally. It's a light that can be experienced, a fear that can be encountered, not just understood. And it's something that we will one day stand before, that we can engage with and listen to and follow today. So that's our quest this year, is not just to get information, but to encounter a God through whom we will understand wisdom.